Thank you. May it please the Court. I'd like to start talking about the sanction in the Trotter case and to try to explain how we came to the analysis that we did. Again, the fee violations or the failed to put things in writing on the fee expenses, and then also as to Mr. Reen's involvement, you know, by themselves, again, they're the kinds of things that we deal with all the time, and most of those issues don't end up here. Mr. Trotter's disciplinary history is different, so even those fee violations standing alone, I'm not sure whether we would have brought him here or not. But the conflict violations added to that, you know, we analyze it, I hope, in the same way that the court would. Is it a conflict? The first question we ask is it a conflict with some direct selfish advantage to the lawyer relative to his client? And then the second, is it knowing and intentional, or is it a result of negligence? Or another way of looking at negligence in this case, and I think how Mr. Cupps was trying to explain it in the last case, is inadequate analysis as opposed to direct intent. Did they really analyze the issue fully to see the conflict?
But our goal is to protect the public.
Yes.
Whether or not it's negligence or inadequate analysis or whether or not it's selfish intent, our goal is to protect the public. However, the excuses may be, the public needs to be protected. And as we're looking at it now, would we let these folks into the bar if they had not already been in the bar? With this kind of conduct, we'd be able to us either with a, let's say, a trusted officer in a bank or a used car dealer. I mean, how would we let these folks into the bar if this kind of conduct, whether or not excused or excuses are made, had occurred before they applied for the bar?
We do think that intent matters. I mean, in determining discipline, the level of intent matters because just for that very reason, the protection of the public, we think is.
What if we said, okay, no discipline, but they can't practice law? I mean, the point is there's a distinction between punishing someone and protecting the public. An example is someone who's sadly an alcoholic or someone who's addicted. They may not have mens rea in what they do, but we're still intent on protecting the public from them, their actions on the public with our imprimatur as members of the bar.
I think we should have a risk-based analysis on all of these cases. And I think that, you know, sometimes the risk is greater even when we know that it is some mental condition or an alcoholism type condition because of the past.
And we also exercise a bad judgment without any other factor, whether it's drugs or alcohol, whether it's just exercising bad judgment. Is there an analysis that would say, okay, they're negligent, they didn't mean it, they were all good and everything was nice about them, but they hurt people.
Well, they
will hurt people.
Right.
They exercise bad judgment. Some people, we all know, just exercise bad judgment. They may not be evil, they just exercise bad judgment.
Sure.
And why should we let them loose on the public?
Sure.
So you may not want to punish them, but you might want to. The act of practicing law is a privilege, not a right. And we're letting them loose on the public. What point do we say, we don't want to punish you, we're not putting you in jail, we're not doing anything to you, but we want to protect the public?
And that's what we have to do. We have to look at all these cases. We have to try to figure out, even in the neglect cases, when they add up over time and prove or provide some proof that there's a problem that we need to address.
So is that intent, is that predictor? If there's something was done intentionally, it's more of a predictor of future problems, where it's negligence, it can be corrected unless it's repeated, and then it becomes incompetence?
That's the hope. Mm-hmm. It is. And it's the hope that we've been working under at least for 10 or 15 years of trying to be, you know, where it is neglect or where it is some level of not understanding the issues, then we've tried to deal more. And I think the court has I assume the court has wanted us to.
What's the difference in the disciplinary history of these two individuals which justifies a different punishment?
Thank you. Mr. Reen had one admonition in 1999 involving diligence and communication, I think. Mr. Trotter has three admonitions since 2009 and one reprimand by the court in 2012. Now those three admonitions include revealing confidences to a client's family, failing to return unearned fees, and failing to place unearned fees in a trust account, a diligence communication violation for failing to timely file an Eighth Circuit brief on an appointed case, another 1.3 diligence and 1.4 communication for failure to act in a client's collection case, and then the reprimands were the diligence and communication violations.
There was one reprimand or multiple reprimands?
I'm sorry, one reprimand. Actually, I think it had just involved one case also.
Three of the admonitions were in, the three admonitions were in 2009,
right,
which is the time frame of this conduct. Is that right?
Yes.
In fact, one admonition was September 2nd. Is that right in the time frame of this?
It's exactly, yes. This case, the accident in Phelps County occurred in March 2008. The representation extended through July, I think, or August, first week of August of 2009.
Should we think, well, all this bad conduct occurred kind of in the same time frame. Now he recognizes the circumstance, or should we think, gosh, even while he is being admonished, he is continuing to engage in behavior that is in violation? Is it aggravating or mitigating?
Well, it's not mitigating, I wouldn't think. But I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't be aggravating as much as if the admonitions were issued in 2008. Because, you know, the admonitions were actually issued about the same time as some of this conduct.
Was there something going on in his life? Was he getting divorced or something?
I'm sorry?
Was there something going on in his life that caused the problems all at once in 2009? Or any mitigating factors in 2009?
I'm sure Ms. Ritten may be able to answer that better than I can. I mean, at some point he was in civil practice for quite a while, and then he became the prosecutor not too long after this. But I'm not sure what time frame that was.
The reason I asked 2009, because 2009 is when this conduct supposedly occurred.
Well, some of it was in 2008 as well. I mean,
but
you know,
the withdrawal and the conflict?
The conflicts, well, they started occurring as soon as the representation, but they extended when, you're right, Your Honor, they extended when they were asked to withdraw and then didn't withdraw immediately.
You argued that the conflict wasn't from a selfish motive. Did I understand that to be correct?
Yeah, I mean it's all relative. But yes, I mean it's not the one where the lawyer's going to have an immediate I get this if I don't do that. Go ahead.
I'm not sure what kind of a conflict would. Or ignoring a conflict, failing to comply with the conflict rules, when would that be from a selfish motive? If there was a quid pro quo, is that what you're...
Well, these conflicts involve competing client interests, you might say, where we sometimes have conflicts where a lawyer is taking advantage of a client, sexual interest in a client.
Okay, I understand.
Or even, representing one party while having an interest in the Weir case that's cited.
But everyone knew, and it turned out to be so, that the longer they stayed in this case, the more money they would get. Under quantum merit, under some theory, that you would have had that thought at the time, and it turned out that was the deciding factor in the amount of their recovery. So by putting off acknowledging the conflict, as long as they did, they added an additional period of time to their argument that they had earned a fee. That it seems to me as soon as that conflict arose, if they had gotten out of the case then or gotten written consent. If the result of that had been getting out of the case, as it ended up being, their argument for a fee, having earned a fee, would have been much less.
Right.
It just seems to me that,
I'm sorry.
It's just hard to argue that there's no benefit to them in violating the conflict.
Do we know if they would have, do we know if they would have waived it or not? Was that addressed ever? I mean, would she have agreed and he have agreed to the joint representation?
Well, I thought about that, and I don't know the answer, but clients can change their mind on these things. I mean, so even if they had had the waiver back in March of 2008, you know, you can have an unhappy client and they're not likely to want to continue with that way, extend that waiver, and I'm not sure any court would hold them to it.
My understanding is there was no prejudice in the sense that at the end everything was divided 50-50, which is how it started out.
Right. I mean, the conflict, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
So let me ask you about, was there ever a situation, you'll know better than I do on the disciplinary history, was there a situation about a signed baseball or football or something involved with Mr. Trotter or no?
No.
Okay, thank you.
I remember the case. Different part of the state, different lawyers, everything.
The improper withdrawal admonition in February of 2009, what were the circumstances of that improper withdrawal? It was not giving back the fee, as you just said. Is it any more than that?
Nothing else is in the admonition itself. And that's all that's in the record, and frankly, I don't know.
What happens with the admonition, or where does it go? Does it go in the lawyer's journal, or how do people?
It's you know, the rules changed, but at that time, the rules were that admonitions are available to the public, they were available to the public for 3 years, and then after that, they weren't available to the public. They were always available to the court and to our office for consideration in prior discipline. So we keep records of those admonitions. And under the new rules, of course, the admonitions are available to the public at the time of acceptance.
And where are they published? Anywhere? Are they published in the Journal of Missouri Bar?
They have not been published.
They're available if someone calls OCDC and asks about a disciplinary history.
That's right. And what is provided is the admonition itself. We don't provide anything else, and sometimes we may not even have anything else.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court?
May it proceed.
Initially, I want to point out that the violations that we are that OCDC has pursued through the stipulation and on up to this court are really technical violations in this case. They are violations of failing to put things in writing. There is no argument that the...
If they're technical, why do they put them as... Why would we make them a rule? I mean, isn't it somewhere to protect the public? Protect the public to have these agreements in writing because there's a substantial likelihood of misunderstandings if they're not put in writing?
Well, that is true. That is the reason that they are required to be put in writing. But there are times when it's not put in writing and it's also not explained to the client. In these situations, it was orally explained to the client. The client knew of the information, the client wasn't relying on the writing to inform them. The writing would have confirmed the information.
When was it orally explained to them? In the hospital or at another time?
At various points, but certainly, yes, initially in the hospital, the issue of the expenses, because that's where the contract was actually signed, the issue of expenses, the fact that expenses would come out after the percentage was applied to the contingency percentage was applied to the recovery, that the expenses would come out before, so that the percentage would be less that the attorneys would recover. That was discussed, and so expenses were discussed with the client at that time. It's a matter of they were not addressed as they were supposed to be in the contract. But there are certainly instances where not only does the attorney not address it in the contract, but has not orally explained it to the client. So that's why I'm saying it's a technical violation of not having reduced it to writing, but not such a substantive violation as not informing the client about the information. The fee division with Mr. Reen was something that certainly the client was aware of for the year and a half that Mr. Reen and Mr. Trotter jointly represented her. She was in communication. All the rule required was that the relationship, her agreement to that relationship be confirmed in writing. There was no requirement that she sign anything or there be any agreement that she was a part of on that. It just had to be confirmed in writing. And frankly, I'm sure there was enough writing that an argument probably could have been made that it was confirmed in writing in essence. As far as the conflict situations, when Mr. Trotter and Mr. Reen first met with them, Mr. Trotter first and then both of them together, the parties were already, the parties to the underlying case, the clients, were already saying, we have agreed, we are going to divide any recovery we get 50-50. Now, it was a mistake not to reduce all of that to writing and to address the conflict had been resolved because the clients had agreed to a 50-50 split. And then the subsequent attempt to continue to represent Mr. Barton after Ms. Meese discharged them really just flows along from that initial understanding that they had already reached a 50-50 agreement. And I think it's a stretch to say that just because one person says later, hey, how about we change this agreement that we've got, which she acknowledges several times in the record that she understood there was a 50-50 agreement, just because she says later, you know, in light of this, can we switch it to 60-40? And he says no, and then she just keeps on going on for several more months. That's not really an indication that they have now have a conflict with each other.
Well, isn't it customary that in those agreements where you would notify and would receive a waiver of the conflict of interest that counsel advises both parties if that agreement falls apart that they'll be unable to represent either one of them?
Yes,
and that's the kind of advice you gave for years, right?
That is the kind of thing that they should say. Or alternatively, if they both agree that if it falls apart, that counsel can continue to represent one of them, and they're both agreeing to that, they can agree to that. But again, that's a conflict waiver when they're making that agreement. I mean, whatever the parties, you know, really are willing to agree is okay.
But they didn't agree, and it's not clear they understood these rights and these rules. How should we determine what discipline is appropriate for them?
Well, and in terms of mitigation and aggravation and what was asked about in terms of what was going on with Mr. Trotter at the time, Mr. Trotter, as I said, as is in the stipulation, began practicing law in 2002. So in 2007, 2008, you know, he'd been only in practice for 5 or 6 years. He was trying in 2007, 2008 to start up his practice as a solo that he had taken over from this Mr. Clapper. And he was struggling with that. And so all of the prior discipline, the matters arose out of that same time period. The 2007-2008 time period is when...
What had he done previously?
He was working with Mr. Clapper. No, you were in the prosecutor's office. He was in the prosecutor's office.
So this was when all these occurred at one time was when he moved to civil practice, and now he's moved back to being a prosecutor.
Correct, and I would say he was in general practice at that time, not exclusively civil practice, but yes, and now he is practicing criminal law. He does not have any intention of going back into civil practice of law. He's planning on continuing to practice criminal law. It is not in the record, but he informs me that also during that same time period, he was in the middle of getting divorced, ending a 21-year marriage. So he was struggling with trying to set up his own practice, learning how to do that, having trouble managing that, and certainly that's much less structured than being
a
prosecutor.
How long was he in civil or in private practice?
In 2011 is when he went to the prosecutor. Yeah, so 4 years. But it starting in 2009, as he was seeing the problems that he was having from not doing things the way he
Did
should
he
have been.
Did he ever seek help from the Missouri Bar, like in their and then the Alleslager and the management courses and management mentoring kind of resources available to him?
I don't believe that he went to the Missouri Bar, but he did, and in answer to an earlier question, both of them did consult with more experienced attorneys throughout this, the Meese and Barton matter, and did seek help, you know, and advice from more experienced attorneys. But also then in 2009, even though he was still in private practice, he began shifting his practice away from civil practice and getting into the more structured and, for him, more manageable area of criminal practice.
So we were looking for an explanation of why there was a spate of incidents in 2008 and 2009. That was during a short period when he was doing civil, but he's then switched back to mainly criminal until he became a prosecutor again?
Correct. And I would say, actually, the events occurred mostly in 2007, 2008, and then the discipline just took various amounts of time to work its way through the process, considering that this one, you know, most of it occurred in the early 2008 period and is just now getting to the court.
So he consulted other counsel, and they said proceed without a waiver and without a written agreement?
He's indicating that they didn't specifically ask about that conflict issue. My understanding, and I believe the record reflects, that they just really felt that apportionment conflict had been dealt with by Ms. Meese and Mr. Barton, by them functioning as a married couple at the time when they were first signed on as clients, and indicating that they had already sorted out that apportionment from the very beginning. And so I think they just did not recognize that they needed to go ahead and address that conflict issue further and get it documented, get it pinned down, and then perhaps we wouldn't be here with some of this issue.
Is there any real benefit in a two-year probation with monitoring when few, if any, of his prior violations involved rules and situations that are going to reoccur in a prosecutor's office?
I don't believe that it is really necessary. And as we said in our brief, I mean, he has agreed to that, and he's willing to accept that if that's what the OCDC thought was appropriate, and that's what the court, if the court thinks that's appropriate, he's certainly willing to accept that. We believe that would be the most that would be warranted under all of the circumstances of this situation. And certainly if the court wanted to do less than that and not have the monitoring, that would be also within the range of what would be appropriate for these circumstances.
Usually when we do probation, it's like a suspension and a stay. And in this case, it's just probation, which we're all on probation, frankly. I mean, we violate the rules, we face the consequences, unless we didn't really mean it. But so what's the probation for? What happens if he violates probation?
Well, if he violates probation, then he would come back to this court for a determination of what discipline should be imposed at that point.
We changed our rules a couple of years ago to provide for just probation as an alternative, and a condition of the probation is if you violate it, that itself is sanctionable, and you can be disciplined for that.
Correct. The court would then look at him in terms of what discipline should be imposed on him at that time in light of what had occurred in the past and what violations had occurred in his probation. But there would be no reason that he would have to be monitored for the types of things that occurred here. And in light of, I believe OCDC was looking at it from the progressive discipline standpoint that, you know, in light of his past discipline, that it should go up a notch. But again, because all of these events really occurred in the same time frame, this is not one of those situations where he did something, he got disciplined, he didn't learn from that, he did something again. He did it all, kind of things fell apart for a period of time, and they have just taken various periods of time to work their way through the process.
I see no further questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Why has it taken 4 years to get this case to us?
Well, Judge Perry's findings were in 2012. I think we may have heard of it before then, but that's when we didn't get anything until sometime last year. Our probation recommendation does include monitoring, quarterly reporting, compliance with the rules, of course, continuing education with the Missouri Prosecutors Association, and CLEs in ethics issues and in law practice management issues, as well as practicing with a mentor. I think it will be valuable. It is a step up, but it's not just a step up. We think that it actually may be beneficial.
How are these remedial steps reflect on what he did?
I'm sorry?
I mean, prosecutor, how are these remedial steps reflect, as Judge Wilson said, on the violations you say he
Well,
committed?
Two things. One, we did try to include the prosecutor, make sure that, because the Prosecutor Association, not like many years ago, there's all sorts of continuing education programs that they put on, including some practice management and some. You know, it's not a condition of probation that he remain a prosecutor. I mean, we did feel some obligation to address the issues as well. What would happen under a violation of probation or an allegation of violation would be that we'd file a motion for show cause and ask the court to consider further discipline. The court then is permitted to either impose additional probation, suspension, or disbarment. I mean, everything's on the table at that point. And he would get a chance to respond, and then the court could hear it right here, or more likely probably refer it to a disciplinary hearing officer or a panel or even a master, and then bring it back before the court if that's what we needed.
For the record, counsel, Missouri Prosecutors Association had continuing legal education years ago.
I know.
Maybe it's more advanced now.
That's what I understand.
Or different now.
I was there at Tantara in the early 1980s. But no, I think they're more and more than they used to be, more frequent, and they have at least two of those, several-day programs.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.